Hi everybody. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, it's all right. Wave your arms if my voice drops and you can't hear. Well, nice to see everyone. We have a pretty exciting month ahead of us. We're gonna Starting tonight, we're going to read Seeing One Thing Through, Mel's book. And that'll be 3 weeks until the 24th. You remember we have a priest ordination on the 21st. And on the 24th, every day is on all of a sudden, it's going to have five brand new priests. So on the 24th, they're going to come to the seminar in person, some of them, and some of them online, and give little talks about what they're thinking about now on the 24th. And that'll be our last seminar before our break. We'll take a break in July and resume seminar in August. Also, we're going to the new several of the new ordinees just so happens are really brilliant poets. So we're going to do a poetry event on Monday night in Oakland. I think we'll put a notice of it on the website. So it'll be like a Zen priest poetry reading. I'm going to read too, but Denise and Pearl and Shuffy are also going to read. The bookstore is a friend of Shuffy's, so that'll be fun on Monday night. And then the Wednesday after that will be the final seminar and before the break, and you'll hear from all of them. Before all of that, I just want to mention that this Saturday at 10 o'clock in the morning, we're going to have a formal Zen funeral ceremony for Ankh Rick Spencer. And I'm sure I've talked to you about him before. He passed away almost 3 months ago by now, and we've had short memorial services for him in different places. But this is going to be a formal Buddhist funeral ceremony because he was a senior priest of Everyday Zen, and I ordained him and gave him Dharma transmission. So I really wanted to do a funeral for him. So we're going to do it on Saturday morning. And I mentioned that I don't expect most of you to be able to attend. Some of you may. It's online, of course, too. I'm hoping that some of you who knew Rick will be able to attend. But I'm mentioning that because I want to share with you. I mean, Rick was Mel's Dharma grandson, right? And so he's related to Mel. And he had a great teaching that he scrawled on a piece of paper, which I think is in Robin's possession, because it was Robin who told us about this last time we talked about Rick, and I wanted to share it again because it's such a brilliant teaching. This is the teaching that Rick left us. And here's what it says: Notes to self. And then for some reason it says, now and again. Notes to self, now and again. Don't wait. Don't expect. Don't deny or reject. Don't regret. Don't believe your stories. Don't try to be respectable. Don't try to rebel. Don't try to be holy, and don't try to look holy either. Don't try to look good or smart or mean or happy or wise or serious or clever or different. Don't even try to let go, trying but only get in the way. Just be present for this arising moment. What a beautiful teaching, don't you think? And it's Rabban has it written down on a beautiful piece of paper in Rick's handwriting, which I think Laura was going to put that a photograph of that piece of paper on the website. Because I think that's about it. If we just follow those words, I think we'll be fine. That's all we need. So that's Rick's teaching, telescoped into just a few words. So Rick is gone, and Mel, we're reading his book, but he's gone too. Where did they go? Well, they went to the same place that all the Zen priests go when they're finished, which is the same place that everybody goes, though no one can tell you where that place is or what it is exactly. But I can tell you that when a teacher is gone, their teachings take on a stronger flavor. Their teachings become more persuasive because they're no longer present in the world to mess them up. So the teachers kind of stand, the teachings kind of stand strong, you know, because the absence of the teachers has purified their teaching. Because death is the great purifier. So I just thought, remembering Rick, who I'm thinking about, because today I was working on his funeral ceremony, would be a good way to begin Mel's book. So a little bit about the backstory. Jack Shoemaker, who's a publisher and somebody who's been in the Berkeley Dharma and arts community for many, many decades, urged Mel to write a book about his life and his history in Zen especially. And he urged him over and over again, for literally for decades. And at some point, Mel agreed that he would do it, and then he started working on it. And he kept working on it and stopping and working on it and stopping for many more decades, maybe 25 years. He kept working on it and stopping and working on it and stopping. And finally, when he knew that he was close to the end of his life, he called a couple of his close disciples together who were not necessarily literary people or writers or skilled in that in any way, but he called them together to finally get the job done. Now, he had some disciples, myself among them, who were, you know, pretty experienced at writing, and he could have asked any one of us. I'm not the only one. There were several who he could have asked to help him. Sue, for instance, was in Berkeley community, and Sue's an expert at this. But that's not the way he wanted to do it. He wanted to do it his own way. He didn't want to get messed up with anybody who was going to have the authority to tell him, no, no, don't do it this way, do it that way. He didn't want that. He really wanted to do it his own way. So he did. At the end, finally, just before he died, the manuscript was finished and was published posthumously. Well, when the manuscript was in hand and about to be published, came a great uproar and outcry. Because in the manuscript, which is partly his Dharma talks and partly a sort of memoir, in the memoir part, he has great criticisms of Dick Baker, who was the abbot of Zen Center from 1971 to 1983. And he really didn't like Dick Baker. He never liked Dick Baker. And so he really let him have it, you know, in his memoir. So a lot of people were upset about that. And looking back on it now, you know, I find it really remarkable, because, you know, he didn't necessarily talk about it in those days, you know, in public, how he felt about Dick. He was very quiet about it. Dick was, after all, the abbot. He didn't want to criticize him. But what was really remarkable is that student after student after student would leave the Berkeley, including Kathy and I, would leave the Berkeley Zen Center, where there was no option for full-time residential practice, to go to Tassajara, where we could practice full-time. And in order to do that, we would have to become students of Richard Baker, who was the abbot of Zen Center, and was the only one at the Zen Center who had Dharma transmission and could officially accept students. So everybody had to be his student. And so person after person did that, and Mel was always encouraging us to do that because he wanted us to be able to practice more thoroughly than we could at Berkeley. And he never said a single word, you know, be careful, or it's not such a good place, or not such a good teacher. He never said a single word, and nor did he even indicate by any kind of, like, I don't know, body language or wordless gesture that we shouldn't do that. He encouraged us to do that. So to me, that was really impressive, that despite his feeling, he just wanted us to practice. And if that was the way, he was going to encourage us. But anyway, a lot of people, when they read the things that he said about Dick Baker, were really dismayed because they thought, wow, you know, this is going to make Mel look really bad. I mean, you know, how good is it to write a book in which you, you know, criticize, you know, in a, almost a prejudicial way, another Zen teacher? Not a good policy, right? Plus, they didn't think it was going to be very nice for Richard, for Dick, to read that. So they really thought that this should part of the book should be suppressed. It should be taken out. They thought it was like a real catastrophe. And several of us got involved in this question of the catastrophe of this. But we had to admit that maybe this is one of the reasons why Mel didn't want anybody else involved, because maybe he knew that we would feel that way. So we were pretty sure that he wanted this stuff to be in the book. What he wrote, he really wanted to say. So we said, well, it's his book, you know, even though he's not around, it's his book, and it should be the way he wanted it. So it got published that way. And Jack Shoemaker, I think, loved that part the best, because Jack was the publisher also of Shoes Outside the Door, which to me is an infamous book, which to me is a kind of, not only does it take Richard Baker to task, maybe he deserved it, but it takes the whole community to task for enabling that, whatever they thought it was. Anyway, it was Jack was very happy that part was in the book, but a lot of other people weren't. I didn't mind it myself that much, but I could see the point. And so I wrote the foreword to the book. Some of you have the book and maybe already read the foreword, but I actually talk about that in the foreword, and I kind of have an explanation for it, which I think is more or less true. Maybe I'll read that for you. This is my foreword. It's not too long. And I'm assuming that most of you haven't read this, but if you have, it's okay. So this is the foreword, 3 or 4 pages long. It's with great pleasure that I introduce the reader to my teacher and friend of many years, Sojin Mel Weitzman. I met Mel, and I still call him that, though most people refer to him as Sojin Roshi, at the beginning of my Zen practice in the spring of 1970, which was not that far from the beginning of his. Mel was a recently ordained priest whose practice consisted of taking care of the grounds and buildings of the small Zen center he ran in an ordinary house on an ordinary Berkeley street, and of course sitting Zazen faithfully every morning and evening. In those days, Mel was not a Zen teacher. He was a priest, but he was not a Zen teacher. He was happy to practice Zen with whoever showed up. No internet, no advertising, just a phone book listing. The Berkeley Zen Center sign on the door was so small you couldn't see it from the street. There was a coffee can on a table for whatever small cash donations might be offered, though he never asked for any donations, by the young, lightly employed people who were in those days virtually the only audience for Zen practice. As you will learn in these pages, Mel was a straightforward and completely unpretentious person raised poor in Los Angeles during the Depression, which made him almost a generation older than me and most of the 1960s youth like me, and we were the first generation of Americans to seriously study and commit ourselves to Zen practice in large numbers. Mel had begun to practice a half a decade or so before us. So on both counts, his age and his experience in Zen, in those days, 5 years of practice was a really long time. He was a senior person from the beginning. In these pages, he describes the earliest days of Suzuki Roshi's teaching in San Francisco as what came to be the San Francisco Zen Center was beginning to be formed. For the rest of his life, Mel carried those days with him. They formed his personality and his Zen life, simplicity, dedication, and faith were their hallmarks. This book is divided into two sections, a memoir and edited versions of his Dharma talks. The memoir includes, besides vignettes from Mel's early life and memories of Suzuki Roshi and the San Francisco Zen Center, his impressions of Richard Baker, who as a very young man became the second abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center after Suzuki Roshi's untimely death in 1971. Suzuki Roshi was only 67 and had been in America for 12 years. So shockingly young to die these days, especially. That's a shockingly young age. And 12 years to establish a Zen center and a Zen teaching where there was none is a really, really short time. A little explored dimension of the sociology of American Zen is its relation to social class. Most Zen students, then as now, come from the white middle class. They are college graduates, and in most cases, so were their parents. But some Zen students, not that many, but some, Mel was one, did not attend college. He did attend the San Francisco Art Institute, which was like a trade school then. So he didn't come from the middle class parentage. And though it was never mentioned or perhaps even consciously noticed, there was a distinct class division within the Zen Center community. Mel and Richard Baker were on opposite sides of that division. This gave them oppositional views of Zen practice and of Suzuki Roshi. Richard Baker's father was a college professor, and Richard himself, a brilliant intellectual, had attended Harvard, though he dropped out. In Suzuki Roshi, Mel saw himself, a plain and simple Zen priest, solid and devoted. Richard Baker, an impressive person well connected to many of the intellectual and cultural leaders of the time, must have seen something else in Suzuki Roshi, a radical and quietly courageous foil for normative American culture. Mel's Suzuki Roshi was just doing the practice. Richard's Suzuki Roshi was remaking the world. The difference between the two Suzuki Roshis and the two versions of Zen that went with it, which were identical in practice and doctrine but divergent in tone and presentation, was the difference between Mel's and Richard's conditioning. So although Mel's views about Richard, as he states them here, may strike the reader as surprisingly critical and personal, they represent an important division, not only within American Zen at that time, but throughout Zen's history. There's always been a division between simple Zen practice for ordinary people that was done, you know, in the countryside, on the one hand, and Zen as a cultural vanguard on the other, you know, Zen in Kyoto and the great temples and the great intellectuals and the artists and the emperor being involved and so on. There's always been that division. And I should mention here that Richard Baker, with whom I still enjoy a warm relationship, ordained my wife Kathy and me together as priests in 1980, although Mel was our first and our last, our Dharma transmission teacher. Mel's rather strong remarks about Richard in this book illustrate another aspect of his character that might seem at odds with his modest approach to practice. He could be fiercely indignant when he considered something to be incorrect. And it reminds me of One time we were at a conference on Buddhism somehow with academics, and we were in the audience, and there was a panel. And the academics, have a way of talking about Zen that's sort of sanitized and distanced, as if Zen were a little object on a, on a, under a microscope to be examined. So somehow, I don't remember what happened, but somehow Mel took umbrage at something that one of the scholars said, and he got up out of his seat in the audience, walked up to the panel, stood in front of the guy, the scholar on the panel, and took him to task, right there in front of everybody. So he would do stuff like that, and it wasn't, and he didn't do it like as a grandstanding thing. He did it like he just couldn't help himself, It was as if nobody else was there. He just had to tell him this, whatever it was, which I can't remember now. Anyway, here's Mel's preface, and this gives you a feeling for, his writerly voice. This is Mel's preface. It's like half a page long. I have been writing a book for about 25 years. A publisher asked me to write this book. He said, "Will you write a book?" And I said, "Well, there are so many Zen books. Why write another one?" And I still believe that. He said, "I'd like you to do it." So I said, "Okay." And little by little, I've been doing that. And I do have some part of it done. I said to him recently, "I'm getting old, so I'm going to give you some lectures." He said, "No." He didn't want it just to be lectures. He wanted it to be a book about my history. Some people say, "Oh, you don't have to have to do a book of talks. Later, your students will collect your talks and put together a book, like they did for Blanche Hartman and Catherine Thanis and many, many other teachers throughout history." And then other people say, "Oh, you don't have to do a memoir. Someone else can write your biography." So I've collected a number of talks, and I continue to do that. And as I do that, it stimulates me to write my autobiography. I'm in that kind of stage. It's, to me, that's a very weird preface. But anyway, there you go. Okay, now I'm going to read a poem for you. And this is a very intimate poem, which I'm sure I've never published anywhere. It's kind of long. And I actually wrote this poem on Mel's deathbed. I was sitting with him there. I don't know, he was maybe a day or two before death, maybe the last day. He was not conscious. He was traveling through, I don't know what, Bardo realms, because you could see his eyes were shut, but you could see him having visions and things were happening. So I'm sitting there with him in the room. Sometimes somebody would go by bringing something. The oxygen machine is pumping. I'm sitting there looking at the pictures on the wall, looking at Mel. My mind is ranging here and there. I'm thinking of his life. I'm thinking of my own life and of our times together, ranging over by then 50 years. And I'm writing this poem, which has three word lines. So that's what this title of this poem is: Poem in Three Word Lines, written for Mel on his deathbed, December 2020. Remembering who I was, then slow breathing, labored breathing, breathing a job to be earnestly undertaken, and furious fugitive visage as nose pinches, as if force possessed the open mouth, world's dark opening for breathing, breathing, halting, coming, breath chokes soul, soul struggles forth oxygen, machines patient, faithful pulse, faithful constant, dumb machine into drear landscapes, assignment to die, then live or live, then die a woman, a man, flying or floating in space, lambent bodies, twisting, reaching, not yet touching, but within touching's reach in frozen periods of never, but, almost, what we are to one another in time or just in time, almost, but never, without barrier or remnant, revenant revolt of inner sense in which one flies or floats over the world's flying, one's propelled or propels, floating, one's drifting nowhere in the forming era, a way to speak or see a future just up ahead, living in shack on pond, looking out window on the street or in the street against police, driving a cab or sitting down in silence or painting big canvas, cracked open sentence, long lifespan, can't begin to count such numbers, such large numbers, such probabilities in visual world seen without eyes closed, where all's dark, shadows and shapes, person runs toward, away, compelling or compelled, the Jean-Fille who swept my heart away so many times I never could count, in this room people live in so quietly, and caress of words spoken, past presences, knights on horses, damsels in distress, urge to do, need, skill in, images that do cross the darkened spaces of looking, no use speaking in this world or that one, fall into spaces, not images in mirror for fresh words, for breathing, for chilling in the common air, being startled then, restlessness then, remembering the others and the others' times, falling into the poem, a leaf or a blossom, folded and unfolded blossoms on the embankment in yellow light, but a period ends the sentence, a complete stop before another begins, and the line trails off before, after, and seems to end, leads on to dereliction or friction, innumerable meanings, each and every word, each and every line, each and every life, each and every complete sentence, a life sentence drifts toward conclusions, remissions, revisions, transmissions, tragedies of attention pulled up close, spooled out to someone's destiny, skin's texture leathery in age, pink to shades of brown or black, almost purple, shading into night when it is night and planets conjunct, as long ago here on earth as it is in heaven, where you can still hear the call of original words and gaps and interruptions, the parsing into cadences you stopped to hear, darkness between words, their rhyming densities when they faced this music, nowhere else in cosmos but here, a cup, a glass, a straw, a tiny earthen teapot, willing now not to be anyone else, not to be a volume but a chapter in a longer text, like a sailing ship driven by wind and many hands with knowledge, skill, or the past, drives the weight of custom when there's no other movement in the room, when the meaning you desired dissolved or was seen to be chimerical, like a griffin or a centaur, real but not in the way you wanted real, in another way that violated syntax and tied the tongue, while people move up and down inside houses, their steps trace a pathway winding, a shape breathing follows across sky among the things collected many years and placed on wainscoting or mantelpiece, cleaned, rearranged, seen and framed in heart times, in passing or not seen, but felt in a domestic life. You bring when you go, when you can be said to be always in a room or always in many rooms your perceptions have illuminated as you passed, or outdoors in air, the things used, words uttered, expressions of face or hand changing yet consistent over time, then throwing up the arms in jubilation or consternation as if to say, I've had it, I'm gone, but to still be here, embedded in time, moaning with darkened mouth, in pillowed head, frail body under blanket over sheet of soft color in dim, quiet room where unspoken words sound out, but who can hear when turning the page is such a chore? We're myths to one another, enabling feeble stories that keep us going, our jaws working as if to cry out, but won't limit us like this, else we sail away apart from the others and won't hear their murmuring or make out today's news. Whew. It takes me back to those moments. Anyway, I thought you guys could hear that. Actually, I'm reading the proofs for my The Great Road, you know, the continuous practice book that's coming out from Shambhala, and I have the poem in that book, but it doesn't appear anywhere else that I'm aware of. Oh, okay. Well, let me read some sections from Mel and comment on them a little bit, and then I'll be done. Thank you so much for listening to that. I hope it was okay. I'm always of two minds when I get the idea to read a poem for you. On the one hand, I think this will be great. I really want to do this, but then I think no, I don't want to. Probably most of them are not interested, and I don't want to foist this on them. And then a lot of times I don't, but today I did. I want to read you two short sections, and these are from toward the end, in a section called Attitude. They've divided, somebody worked out a way to divide the book into, you know, sections and themes, and this is Attitude. I'm going to read the first two sections of Under Attitude, and they appear on pages 283 and the next three or four pages after that. The first one is called Extending from the Center, and the second one is called Commitment. Extending from the Center. It seems to me that our body-mind is like a microcosm of the universe. The center of the universe within each of us is correctly called the solar plexus, while the extensions, the arms, legs, head, are like the planetary satellites that make up our human mandala. The thinking mind, the feelings, emotions, consciousness, and breath are manifestations of this vital center. The vital center has various names, such as qi or qi or so on in Chinese, which means breath, strength, unity, peace, or happiness. It also refers to our calm, impartial mind and the seat of our intuition. Our activity in the Zendo is based on this understanding. That's an interesting thing, right? A whole cosmology with the belly as the center of the body and the center of our energy and the center of our universe. In Zazen, all the extensions, arms, legs, breath, thoughts, etc., take place in a harmonious balance around the vital center. The function of the thinking mind is to think the thought of Zazen. That's pretty good. The function of the thinking mind is to think the thought of Zazen without getting sidetracked and to encourage the other limbs to maintain their function. I guess he's talking about when you're doing Zazen. I don't think he means that you should think the thought of Zazen all the time, but maybe he does. No, he says in Zazen, so I guess he means in Zazen. This attitude will then be extended to all of our activity. When we are serving food in the Zendo, we learn to maintain the same harmonious balance. Our mandala, which extends from our vital center, meets and mingles with the mandala of the person who is being served. When we walk up the aisle, we are aware of doing so quietly. When we serve the food, we gently stir the goodies up from the bottom of the pot. In other words, we maintain the spirit of Zazen through awareness of the harmony of body, breath, and mind, together with mindful attention to the materials we are working with. We treat the pots and pans and bowls and utensils with respect according to their shape and function. And in a sesshin or in the monastery, you're serving three meals a day in the Zendo, so there's lots of that going on. And we try to have orioki, but even when we do, we don't serve it in the Zendo, because you really have to have a whole temple for that. But we do have tea service, right? And so in sesshin, we really, really appreciate serving tea and receiving tea and all the same principles that he's talking about here for serving a meal work with serving tea. Serving in the Zendo is a really powerful practice. I'm really sorry that we can't do orioki and have serving meals, but that makes tea all the more precious when we do it. Now he talks about the doan, the bells. The doan learns to sound the bells without punishing them. That's great, right? Without punishing them. Sounding the bell is an act of love, an offering to the Sangha. And he had a wonderful way of teaching that. I remember many, many years ago him teaching me how to touch the bells with the striker. Although the hand holds the striker, the impulse begins in the hara, the center of the body, and extends through the arm, hand, and striker. And the resonance of the bell reflects the inspiring intention of the doan, which in turn inspires the chanting. The same for the fukudo, who maintains the beat and the rhythm while resonating with the hollow sound of the fish-shaped drum. Suzuki Roshi used to admonish us not to give the poor thing a heart attack, not to whack on the drum. In Tassajara, they had a really big drum, a really big mokugyo, and you could whack it pretty hard if you wanted. And the kokyo, who leads the chant, should find a pitch that is not too high and not too low so that everyone can feel comfortable leading the chant without being strident. The secret is to lead and follow at the same time. And it is a magical thing when everything in the service, the chanting, the leader of the chant, the doan, the bells, when it all harmonizes and flows, it's a wonderful feeling. We don't do it that often, so it's hard for us to get that feeling, but we're getting better at it. We're getting better at it. And sometimes we feel it. Breathing deeply, not just in Zazen, but continuously, is how we remain centered. When we move and our movements extend from the center, we can move with ease and grace without restriction. As our life is transformative, we can inhale adversity and exhale love. The purpose is not to become an expert, but simply to be a vehicle of light, a Buddha field for our surroundings. And I think these last two sentences are really precious. And did you see that he's talking about, whether he's directly referencing it or not, this is the practice of Tonglen, sending and receiving, right? As our life is transformative, our life is inherently transformative. If we don't stand in the way of that transformation, our lives will always be transformative. That's Dogen's teaching of continuous practice and Buddha nature. As our life is transformative, we can inhale adversity and exhale love. We can inhale adversity and exhale love. That's the practice of sending and receiving. Inhaling the suffering, the adversity, the difficulty, even if it's our own, and exhaling love, because our body can transform suffering and adversity into love. It's an amazing thing that we are capable of, every one of us. Then he says, the purpose is not to become an expert, but simply to be a vehicle of light, a Buddha field for our surroundings. And that's the purpose of our practice, not to be an expert, not to be like a Zen genius, or to ask me anything, you know, but to be a vehicle of light, a Buddha field to spread all around us without thinking we're spreading it all around us or knowing we're spreading it all around us. Beautiful, beautiful saying by Mel. Okay, commitment is the next one. Commitment. Commitment to ourselves. Isn't that striking? Commitment. We always think of commitment. I don't like commitment because I like myself. I mean, I commit to somebody else or something else. I'm not so sure. You know, how do I know if I should trust them? No. He says commitment to ourselves. It's surprising. Commitment to ourselves is most important if we want to have a steady practice. Did you ever think of it that way? Commitment to ourselves is the most important thing if we want to have a steady practice. Of course, sometimes we're just looking and we come and practice for a while to see what it's like. That's fine too. But I think it's helpful to give yourself the opportunity of committing to a practice schedule for some short space of time just to see what that's like, regardless of what your feelings are about it. So, you know, don't just show up, I don't like it, I'm gone, but give yourself time, even if you don't like it, just to make a commitment. I'm going to be here for a week, a month, try this for a year. I'll just try this for 50 years, and if I don't like it, I'll do something else, you know, like that. So, but no, I mean, a week. I often tell people, you know, try, sit every day for a week and see what happens, and then quit after that and see if there's a difference. So that's what he's saying. Try it out. Even if you don't like it, keep it up for the commitment that you've made. When you finally start practicing Zazen, and particularly if you sit Sashin and your legs begin to hurt, or if your back is some old problem, or if there are thoughts running through your head all the time, you'll want to get more comfortable, and you may feel, get me out of here, or I would definitely rather be doing something else. But what keeps you here is your commitment. And through your commitment, you can see how feelings and thoughts arise and how these feelings and thoughts are always trying to pull us around by the nose one way or the other. It's hard to see something all the way through. The title of the book, right? It's hard to see something all the way through because as soon as things get a little difficult, we want to escape. And when we keep trying to escape from reality, we lose ourselves. We are no longer present. We are no longer settled on ourselves. That's a powerful thing because we don't think we're escaping from reality. We think we're just escaping from this unpleasant situation. Shouldn't we all get out of unpleasant situations? No. We are escaping from reality, he says, and so we lose ourselves. And we're no longer present. We're no longer settled on ourselves. That might be a foreign concept to a lot of people who think it makes perfect sense to get out of a bad situation as soon as possible. We have to be careful that we don't sell Buddhism as the opium of the people or as something euphoric. The fifth precept is don't sell liquor or intoxicants. Sometimes it's interpreted as don't become intoxicated. Sometimes it's interpreted as don't sell Buddha Dharma as wine or something intoxicating, as if it will take all your cares away or make you feel wonderful. And the precept is actually best interpreted that way for teachers. Actually, that's the way teachers should, even more important for a teacher not to get intoxicated is not to intoxicate others with the Dharma, to try to entice people. This is wonderful, you'll love it, just listen to me. You know, that's really bad precept to break for teachers. What Zen does is sit us down right in the middle of reality, between pleasure and pain, between good and bad, so that we accept everything equally. I'll read that again because that's really great. What Zen does is sit us down right in the middle of reality, between pleasure and pain, between good and bad, so that we accept everything equally. We don't try to run away from our difficulties to some kind of pleasant state, or run away from some pleasant state just because it's pleasant. When something pleasant arises, it's just pleasant. When something painful arises, it's just painful. When something easy arises, it's just easy. When something difficult arises, it's just difficult. The only way that we can really practice this is through our commitment, because otherwise, as soon as things get difficult, we will want something pleasant. Feelings are important. We should accept our feelings. But Zen is the practice of not escaping. There is no way out except to be whatever is happening. When we depend on our feelings too much, we can't experience things completely. How about that? We should write that one down and think about that for 5 or 10 years. When we depend on our feelings too much, we can't experience things completely. What in the world does that mean? How in the world could we understand that personally with our own lives? I mean, I recommend you think about that. The only way is to give up our self-centeredness. He talks then about Genjo Koan. I'll skip a few sentences. Genjo Koan means something like a thing's position on level ground. The word Genjo Koan means something like a thing's position on level ground, manifesting in the present, like our life, moment by moment, manifesting in this phenomenal world as an expression of absolute reality, which is what Zazen is. Our life, moment by moment, manifesting in this phenomenal world as an expression of absolute reality. And that's what Zazen is. The koan of manifesting in the present, moment by moment, in reality. Skipping a little bit. To study the way, to study the Buddha Dharma, is to study the self. Here, self doesn't mean study in the sense of reading a book. The word study here means to do something over and over and over again, constantly doing something until it becomes part of you, until it becomes you, actually. This is to study the self, and it's like Zazen. In order to practice Zazen, you do it over and over until you get it through your pores. And when you get it through your pores, then you can drop the self, because you realize that all the things you meet are yourself. To be enlightened by 10,000 things is to meet everything as yourself. That is so true, that everything is yourself. Every thought, every perception, every other person you encounter, everything is yourself. To meet everything without running away is the practice. Zazen is a kind of unconditioned practice when you can just exist as absolute, as an expression of reality without discrimination. You just let everything come as it comes and go as it goes. It's a wonderful practice, but it's not so easy. It's not easy to just sit still. It takes all of your integrity to just be able to sit without any expectation. Expectation is what gets us into trouble, and we think, it feels very good now. This must be the enlightened state. But as soon as you think that, it changes. Then we think, how can the enlightened state suddenly get so miserable? We try all of the tricks in our mind to justify our feelings, but nothing works until you finally just let go. Then you can sit still. But you have to get to the point where you sit long enough so you can just sit still. It just happens by itself. This is why I say, commitment is so important. You don't get to that place through your feelings. You only get to that place through your commitment to see something through. Well, I think that was a very essential teaching of Mel's. And I think that he's right. I think that's the teaching of the lineage and of the Buddha Dharma. So those are the things I wanted to share with you tonight. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it, as I always do. And I think that this statement about commitment to yourself, it's a strange idea, commitment to yourself. And he seems to think that to practice with your whole heart and commit yourself to practice is to commit, make a commitment to yourself. So I put that to you as a question for the groups. I think we have time for each person to speak in the group for 3 minutes, 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 3 more. That's 12 minutes, so about 15 minutes from now, I'll see you again. And in your groups, I think I don't need to say anything because everybody here, I think, knows how we do the groups. They're 3-minute monologues. Each person has 3 minutes without an interruption. And at the end, there's 3 extra minutes for anything extra to say. And please do your best to address this question. Commitment to myself. What does that mean to me? Commitment to myself. So, Shafi's our Zoom host tonight, and you'll put everybody in the groups, and I'll see you all about 15 minutes from now. I hope you'll have good and enlightening discussions. Thank you. Shafi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi.
Hi.
Here I am. I just realized that I promised John that I would announce the Sangha Week is at Tassajara, July 7th to 12th. Can you send a note to all the groups? Can you do that? Send a chat, to all the groups? Is that possible?